And sheep's clothing?
Worse. When Morton and Hale brought them back to Terra Nova, they tried to assimilate them into the colony, but there was a lot more resistance than they anticipated.
Surprised the shit out of me, but there were more people apprehensive about the whole thing than weren't.
We shared information with them, and eventually someone let slip we had Doughboy tech with us. The Archduke was very interested, got into the system, and made himself an army.
They took Jared and the other leader, including their families, first, segregating them away from the rest of the population. They ran some brutal experiments trying to find a way to make the Doughboys obey the Triumvirate, but the Doughboys were hardwired to obey Jared, so they bent Jared to their will and attacked the city. I took the two boys and left when the hammer dropped. Eric did too.
Why were the Nether Guard after you?
Shannon nodded.
Doughboy production and making procedurals have some similarities. Jared must have told the Triumvirate about the tech, and they were interested. Very interested. Guess they weren't happy with the robot bodies. But there was only one procedural on the Terra Nova mission. She tapped her chest. They needed my genome to recreate the process. Oh, that Archduke is talented, I'll give him that. So the Nether Guard were after me for a bit, but they degraded quickly and were useless trying to track me down without Jared holding the leash. Guess the Triumvirate decided to focus Jared to get their starship built instead of finding me. They wanted to get home more than they wanted flesh and blood bodies.
You don't seem too surprised that Ibarra had other copies of you. Shannon touched her right temple.
I was having headaches not long after we first arrived.
Docs found recording chips on my ocular and audio nerves, recording everything I saw and heard on a database implanted in my brainstem.
Not great as a collection device, as it would take surgery to access.
Docs did some more poking around and found that I had a good deal of plastic surgery to change my appearance that I didn't remember, and my genes matched for someone of pure Norwegian descent. I'm half Korean, half Polish. At least that's what I remember.
Only logical explanation was that Ibarra really was a mad scientist all these years,
Knight said.
Back when the Ember War began and the Zaros wiped out everyone on Earth, I thought she was in Phoenix when it happened. I was surprised to see her after we recaptured the planet. I just chalked it up as Ibarra sneaking her onto the fleet that survived at the last minute.
That son of a bitch Ibarra swore that this...
She traced a hasty circle around her face.
Was impossible.
That he'd never make a golem, or gola, I guess you could call me, a knockoff of a dead person.
Come on, Hale said, surprised. Did you really trust Ibarra 100%? You worked with him closer than anyone else. Besides, maybe his granddaughter. You knew the kind of man he was.
Never was one to throw away a tool he liked. Are there still copies of me floating around back home?
She sighed. No, Hale said, there's not. Your last copy was compromised in the nascence tubes by the Nerusha. That Shannon mortally wounded Ibarra's granddaughter before it was destroyed. Shannon sat forward.
Stacy? She's dead?
No, not dead. Hale hesitated. She survived. But how she's still alive is a bit hard to explain.
We leave the boss alone for 10 minutes, and look what happens,
Knight said.
But that your procedural was vital to the Triumvirate, Hale said. They captured one of my pathfinders on Negev. Seems they found what they needed from her.
You brought Procyes?
Shannon raised an eyebrow.
Many. Ibarra wasn't in charge of my mission, so you and the boys, Hale said. You ended up at the data farm?
Right. You know, for how smart the Triumvirate is, they're pretty freaking stupid. They made a couple trips out there, searching, but gave up after coming up empty-handed. It was actually pretty peaceful out there once you got used to the incessant humming of the server racks.
Drove me crazy for the first few days. Hale turned to Knight.
And how'd you manage to escape the attack?
The man smiled.
She's not the only one with a sixth sense for these things. It's not my first rodeo. I hid out in the city for a while before the Nether Guards started locking everything down. Once they repurposed the mining freighters as prisoner transports, I beat feet. I spent a few months playing cat and mouse, taking out one or two here and there. We kept in pretty regular contact.
He nodded to Shannon.
But I didn't want to take the chance I'd lead those bastards to her and the boys, so I stayed away.
Must have been rough.
Actually, it wasn't that bad until I got hit by a damn scrimshaw.
A what? Hale asked, frowning.
Scrimshaw,
Knight said.
Poisonous lizard. They look like a pile of rocks right up to the point it decides to bite the shit out of you. Took a big chunk out of my leg.
Knight pulled his right pant leg up. The lower half of his leg was gone, cut off just below the knee. Jagged scars and mutilated skin looked like it had been pulled together with no thought at all to aesthetics.
The rest we had to get rid of later. Can't very well run when your leg has fallen off,
Knight said. He nodded to Shannon.
I managed to get word out before I passed out, and she found me. Saved my life.
And what? Hale asked. You just decided to leave the boys to their fate?
Jesus, Hale. No, I'm not a monster, Shannon said. By the time I got Eric situated and stable, the feral Netherguard had wandered into Fight's Valley and were feeding on the fish and rodents. Trying to get this gimp through that would have been suicide. It was shitty, I know. I felt bad about leaving them to themselves, but I couldn't leave him to die.
Fortunately, they survived without you. Barely, Hale said.
Can I see them?
Eventually. Right now, they're still coming to terms with everything. Hale paused, conflicted between asking his next question and not wanting to know the answer. What happened to my brother? Why is he working for the Triumvirate?
They took his family. His wife was pregnant. They locked her and their daughter into one of their stasis chambers, using them as leverage against him. He didn't have much of a choice. I doubt he still does. Jared is their golden ticket. He's the only thing keeping them in business right now, until they figure out another way to control their armies.
Jared was married. I have a niece.
Hale's face went stoic.
Either of you know how to work the Doughboy tubes? You, Shannon, I know you have experience with procedural technology. You worked with some of my strike marines on the Crucible during the war.
Shannon shot him a questioning look. I did?
Hale squeezed the bridge of his nose, feeling a migraine coming on. A Shannon helped my marines.
Ibarra is still causing me headaches. We know how to work the Doughboy producers,
Knight said.
The boss made sure we could handle any delicate task he might need done.
What do you need, boss?
Shannon asked. Chapter 3 Valiant's plot cast flickering shadows across the bridge as the ship slipped through the debris field. Shattered hunks of hull plating drifted with sections of silvery-colored metal. The field of broken starships had expanded since the battle, forming a loose nebula to mark where so much death and destruction had marred the skies over Negev. Carson thought she saw a humanoid body drift between the blown-out wreckage of a small destroyer. With the rest of her interior lights off, the hologram lit the pilots' faces with a soft orange hue. They'd gone to silent running as they'd neared the planet, just in case any active ships remained. Carson leaned against Greer's seat, looking through Valiant's front viewport, in awe at the destruction around her. A cloud of dead ships hung in the void over the red planet, an alien graveyard. According to Valiant's sensors, the debris field was some 200 kilometers across. The entire area filled with wrecked ships, jagged hull fragments, and alien corpses.
Look at that one,
Greer said, pointing to one of the large ships. The computer tagged it as an SI ship, but even without the tags, Carson would have been able to tell the difference. The ships belonging to the Sacred Intelligence had a streamlined look, their hulls sleek and arrow-shaped. The Altari ships were more utilitarian, with clusters of sensors, weapons turrets, and some bulbous outcroppings that Carson couldn't identify. The frigate-sized SI ship had a shuttle-sized rent in her armor and trailed an ever-expanding cloud of debris as it slowly rotated in the void. Greer slowed the Valiant, turning it so they could get a better look at the destroyed ship.
Those torpedoes really pack a punch, don't they? Greer said.
Carson counted 20 small craters where energy beams had cut through the sleek, chrome hull of the ship.
Looks like all their weapons do. Guess we can count our blessings that they decided to beat feet and not continue on to the colony.
Count your blessings all you want, Carson said. I have a feeling that we're not done with either of these groups yet.
It doesn't look like the engineering section was hit badly. Mark it for future investigation. We can always come back and check it out. I'm gonna get suited up. Let me know if anything crazy pops up.
Define crazy, Greer said.
Dealer's choice.
Greer chuckled.
Well, I am a pilot, so...
Just keep your eyes open.
Half an hour later, Carson was in her void suit, helmet cradled under one arm, her other arm propped on the back of Greer's seat. Wes stood to her right, behind the co-pilot seat, where Oscar Lincoln was busy marking points of interest on his console for further study. The eggheads back on Terra Nova would have months' worth of data to pour through when they got back, not to mention the technicians and scientists in Valiant's Bay already going over the information in their makeshift lab. Danielle Scartucci stood off to one side, quietly observing. From her expression, Carson gathered being back here, even if it was just in orbit of her former prison, wasn't sitting too well with the scientist. She wore a naval hazardous duty vac suit, lightly armored to survive a ship-to-ship fight and work in the void, and looked uncomfortable in it. The engineer had worked extensively on Altari technology while enslaved on Negev, building the Triumvirate's ship. She was the closest thing Terra Nova had to an expert on the alien's tech. They'd catalogued 3 SI ships and 2 Altari that appear to be relatively whole and another 27 that were nothing more than charred and twisted metal. Deep sensor scans showed that one of the SI ship's engines was still intact and functioning, emitting faint power levels. However, they could detect no signs of life.
That looks promising, Lincoln said, nodding to the holo image of an SI ship rotating above the console. The hull's damaged in several places, but should support a research team or two.
I'll get my team ready, Danielle said.
Now hold on, Carson said, holding up a hand. No one goes anywhere until we're sure the area's clear of hostiles. Then the priority is search and rescue of any survivors, period.
The scientist stopped mid-turn. Chief, everything out here is dead. Days without power. Even our life pods won't last that long. I don't think we have anything to worry about.
We shall see, Doctor, Carson said. We don't know anything about either of these 2 races or the technology, and until we've completed a full sweep of the area and determined that it's safe, all civilian personnel will remain on board the ship.
Danielle looked like she was about to argue, then appeared to think better of it. She nodded and returned to her position next to West. Silence fell over Valiant's cockpit as they floated through the debris field. Messages flashed and sensor images continued to flash on screens as Valiant's computers chewed through the data, tagging and identifying ships. A red light flickered on Lincoln's console and he sat up.
Now that's interesting.
Greer leaned over.
What you got?
Looks like some kind of beacon, the co-pilot said, fingers tapping. Repeating sequence starts over every 35 seconds. Computer still working on the translation, but I'd put money on an SOS.
Which ship?
Carson asked. Lincoln tapped a button and a sleek, arrow-shaped ship appeared, its hull drawn in orange wireframe. The large SI ship hung in the void at the outer edge of the battlefield, perilously close to Negev and its gravity well. By human standards, the ship could have been classified as a cruiser, and Carson wondered exactly how big the alien ships went. It didn't matter, of course. The colony fleet wouldn't be able to stand up to even the smaller frigate-sized ships if it came to that. A holo image of the cruiser flickered to life above the center console in front of Carson and slowly rotated in place, giving them a better picture of the dead ship. 3 large craters had torn open the hull on the near side of the ship, exposing the cruiser's interior to vacuum. At one end of the craters, a cylindrical ship like a cigar stuck out of the ship's hull. Aside from the car-sized holes in the hull, the cruiser looked relatively intact.
Boarding craft, Greer said.
Looks like 4 landed, Carson said. Only 3 left.
Doesn't make any sense, Greer said. All the rest of the Altari fleet seemed to be hell-bent on destroying the SI ships, not boarding them.
Smash and grab? West asked. Strike Marines trained for that. Get a team aboard a larger vessel and disable a key system, obtain intelligence, then get the hell out of there.
Carson nodded.
Their torpedoes were doing a fine enough job of destroying the SI ships. The Altari sent boarders, so there must have been a damn good reason for it.
It's the biggest SI vessel we've located so far, West said. Might be a good place to start looking for something to salvage.
I'm picking up minimal power signals, Lincoln said. The engines are offline, but some systems seem to still be operational. There doesn't appear to be any signs of life, but the old girl's sensors can't detect everything. He gave his armrest a pat.
At the very least, we might be able to get an idea of what the Altari were after,
West said. Danielle leaned forward, hands on the back of Lincoln's chair.
If you can get me a tap connection into the ship's systems, I might be able to download some of the core data.
Its orbit is decaying,
Lincoln said, tapping on his console.
Estimate 4 hours until it hits Negev's atmosphere.
Carson pursed her lips, considering.
We won't get another shot at it,
West said.
Carson put a hand on Greer's shoulder.
Stay frosty. We call for an emergency evac, that means we need to be off that wreck 5 minutes before we even hit the old crap button. Understand?
Greer nodded.
Gotcha, Chief.
Get us as close as you can, Carson said. Those breach points should make for a good entry. Should be no problem for our suits grapplers.
Greer looked back over her shoulder.
You sure you don't want a Superman in again?
Carson grinned.
Maybe next time.
Carson turned to Danielle.
You're coming with us.
Sure, Danielle frowned. Soon as you're sure it's safe, I'll bring my...
No time to pussyfoot around?
Carson slapped her on the shoulder.
You're on the breach team. Don't worry. You don't have to be the first one inside.
Thank God for small favors, Danielle muttered. 5 minutes later, Carson stood next to Valiant's cargo ramp, her team of Pathfinders standing a few feet away, void suits sealed and weapons ready. She couldn't see their faces through the mirrored visors on their helmets, but they'd had their names stenciled to their uniforms, and after enough drills and rehearsals, she could tell her team by size and gait alone. An alert chimed in Carson's helmet, and Greer's voice came through the comm.
5 meters, Chief.
Roger that,
Carson tapped the ramp release. A flashing orange strobe changed to red, and an alarm rang out as the ramp unlocked and began to lower. A force field, preventing Valiant's atmosphere from venting violently into the void, glowed blue around the edges of the hatch. Exterior lights mounted on Valiant's hull illuminated the alien ship. The sleek gray hull floated several meters away from the end of the ramp. A large, jagged hole in the otherwise smooth skin appeared as the Valiant slid down the length of the ship. Shadows danced inside the deep crater as light reflected off broken and twisted pieces of metallic alloy.
Reminds me of the Midway, West said over the IR.
The Midway? Nunez asked. I heard stories about that mission. Made my skin crawl. Saros killed the whole crew, right?
Ship came through the crucible. Looked fine at first. Then the hull broke apart into Zaro's drones and wrecked the Sari shipyards.
West said,
we would have lost more, but the Dotari had a fighter wing on standby that saved the jump gate and the rest of what we had on Sari's. I was on the SNR team that did the sweep of the Midway after the fight. Ghost ship. We found empty void suits, blood on the bulkheads, not a single body. Fit with what we knew about how the Zaros fought with their disintegration technology. But knowing that didn't take the edge off. I saw President Garrett, Admiral Garrett back then, leave the ship with his Ranger bodyguard, clutching Admiral Makarov's empty vac suit. Never thought I'd see a flag raid officer look so afraid.
Eighth Fleet was lost with all hands, Birch said. A lot of good men and women died to buy Earth enough time to prep for the next invasion wave.
Anyone have a happy story about ghost ships? Nunez asked. For Danielle's sake, she looks terrified.
I'm fine, the engineer said, her voice cracking.
Okay, people, Carson said. We're on the clock for this one. Search for survivors is priority one. Gathering intel comes next. We're going for the source of the energy emissions first. Anything else is a bonus. Keep your heads up and stay sharp. Pathfinders, light the darkness.
Her team snapped to attention, shouting, we are the torch. Carson turned and lifted her hand. She fired the grappler, a heavy-duty magnetic piton attached to a gauntlet by a high-strength wire. It struck the alien ship's hull and held firm, the HUD inside Carson's helmet advising her she had a good lock. She moved down Valiant's ramp, then pushed off into the void, retracting the grappler's cable as she floated toward the gaping maw. The grav linings in her boots adjusted her course slightly, centering her on the hole. At 2 meters, she fired her second grappler. It shot out from her other gauntlet, through the jagged hole, into the ship's interior. It locked into place on the bulkhead and pulled Carson the rest of the way in, her first grappler automatically disengaging, retracting into its recess. Carson touched down on the deck and engaged her boots. The grav lining simulated a 1G environment for the boots' wearers, keeping her firmly attached to the deck. She unlocked her carbine from its maglock on her back and activated her suit's lights. 2 beams of light from emitters mounted on either side of her helmet cut through the ship's dark corridor.
"I'm in," Carson said.
"I've got a good signal on your beacon," Greer said. "I'm getting some faint power readings from the bow. Could be a containment field. Might mean there's still atmo."
"Roger that,"
Carson said, sweeping her light in both directions, fore and aft. Behind her, toward the ship's aft section, Valiant's lights illuminated the corridor through the 2 gaping holes gouged out of the ship's hull. Shadows danced on the deck and bulkhead, revealing clusters of scorch marks along the ship's interior. Past the jagged opening in the hull, Carson's light reflected off the chrome surface of the remaining boarding craft still wedged through the hull. A hatch on the side of the craft hung open, revealing a dark interior. Carson moved toward the craft, weapon up and ready. Her team landed one by one on the deck behind her, each acknowledging a safe landing as they touched down. She stopped a few feet away from the open hatch, lifting her weapon slightly, using the barrel light to illuminate the interior. A single body slowly rotated just inside the hatch, surrounded by balls of maroon liquid. Blood, Carson realized. A foot connected with one of the floating orbs of blood, it splattered into several smaller orbs, splashing against the bulkhead and spinning through the void.
"Got a body," Carson said, advancing.
The corpse was dressed in all black. What looked like a void suit was skin tight and had several spikes sticking out from its forearms and calves and shoulders. Symbols, painted in red, covered its armored chest. Streaks, where the paint had run before drying, ran down the length of the torso, stopping where the waist armor folded over the abdominal area. Carson aimed her carbine's light up as the corpse rotated, its head coming into view. The void helmet's glass front was smashed, revealing the alien's gray, lifeless face inside. The long, angled jaw and sunken eye sockets reminded Carson of the Nether Guard. Nunez stepped up beside her and nudged the corpse's foot with the barrel of his carbine, making it spin slightly faster.
"Creepy."
"I'd like to take that back with us for autopsy,"
Moretti said. Carson nodded.
"We'll grab it on the way out. Greer?"
"Here, Chief. Keep this connection open. Are you receiving the data from our suits?"
"Roger. Reading everyone's signal 5x5.
"Good. We're gonna head toward that power source. See if you can guide us there."
The team set off through the ship, Nunez at the point, West and Danielle bringing up the rear. As they made their way through the twisting corridors, signs of battle became more and more visible. Blast marks from energy weapons scarred the bulkhead, ceiling, and deck. One section of bulkhead had been completely destroyed by an explosion, turning half of the corridor into a jumble of twisted metal. They came to a sealed hatchway covered in blast marks. The doors had raised symbols running up and down the door seam. Though Carson had no idea what they meant, 2 alien bodies floated above the deck, one dressed in the same black demon-looking armor as the one in the boarding craft. The other was a distinctly robotic frame, thin metal arms and legs connected to a cylindrical chassis. Its head was little more than a metal sphere with 2 dark lenses that obviously served as the thing's eyes.
"That looked like a droid to anyone else?" Carson asked.
"Makes sense," West said. "They called the other aliens the Sacred Intelligence. Might suggest that it's a race of robots."
"That's unusual," Carson said.
There had been a single recorded first contact with an artificial intelligence species in the Milky Way, a race called the Djinn that had vanished after that encounter. Pathfinders were trained in all manner of first contact, but with biological aliens, not artificial.
"Looks like the fighting was intense here,"
Birch said, motioning to the bodies. Greer's voice came over the IR.
"You're right next to the containment field, Chief. My guess is a command center of some sort on the other side of that hatch."
"Copy," Carson said. "Nunez, plasma torch."
"Roger that, Chief."
Nunez racked his carbine on its magnetic clamps on his back and pulled the small cutting tool from a pouch on his tactical harness. West and Birch pulled the floating corpses out of the way, and Nunez went to work. Sparks sprayed from where the torch cut into the metal, loading out in all directions before blinking out of existence.
"Doesn't look too advanced,"
West said, inspecting the robot's chassis.
Matter of fact, I'd say our robotic technology is above this.
You'd think a race of AI droids would be top of the line,
Birch said.
Almost through, Nunes said. Greer, are you picking up any signs of life on the other side?
Carson asked.
None.
Nunes finished cutting and put the torch away. After attaching a suction handle to the metal, he paused, looking to Carson for the go-ahead.
Standard entry maneuvers, Carson said. Pop off left, Birch right. West, you and I have the middle. Ready?
Go! Nunes pulled the cut section free from the rest of the door, stepping aside and letting it float down the hall. A blue shimmering light filled the open space. Popoff stepped up, putting a hand against the wall of energy. It passed through, the edges of the field flaring blue-white, and without hesitation, she stepped through. Birch followed, turning right as Popoff turned left. West and Carson followed them through as Nunes secured their rear. Lights from the team's suits cut tight beams through the space, flashing off metal rails, computer stations, and bulkheads. As they cleared the individual sectors of fire, several beams of light met in the center of the room, illuminating a circular arrangement of chairs, occupied by alien corpses. All had blast wounds to their torsos, their faces frozen mid-death scream.
We've got atmosphere in here.
West tapped his foot against the deck, and Carson heard the sound through her helmet.
Still no gravity.
At most thin, Moretti said. 24 kPa, which is thinner than the top of Mount Everest.
Think that's normal for these aliens? Popoff asked.
No, the medic said. You'd see much larger ears and nasal passages. Plus, any creature at that little atmosphere would encounter a lot more radiation, and then...
You are good at no, Popoff said.
Air's a standard mix of oxygen, nitrogen, and carbon dioxide,
the medic said.
But what's optimal for them is hard to gauge. I think they lost a good deal of their air pressure before the emergency force fields kicked on.
None of the alien crew were wearing void suits, their grayish flesh rimmed with ice crystals. Despite the wires and plugs connecting them to their chairs, and some plating at the back of their necks, these aliens also bore a close resemblance to the Nether Guard. Several of the aliens floated above their chairs held in place by cables.
Altari, Carson thought.
But that didn't make any sense. Weren't they on an SI ship? Several humanoid-shaped droids floated around the space, charred silver chassis punctured by some kind of beam weapon. Sparks shot out from one, causing its body to flinch.
Cyborgs?
West asked, stepping up to the first chair.
So much for being totally artificial.
Moretti said.
Look at this one,
Popoff said, aiming her light at one of the cyborgs. Its head was missing, cut clean from its neck. Exposed, thin wires, veins, and tendons floated freely like tiny streamers.
Wonder who he pissed off, Nunes said.
Popoff, Carson said. You and Danielle work on patching into the core.
Roger.
West paused beside Carson, his carbine's light angled up at the ceiling.
Edge up.
Another alien corpse, this one dressed in the same armor as the one in the boarding craft, hung against the ceiling, a severed head grasped in its hand. Another light joined West's, and Moretti said,
He's been hit. See there, on his side. Looks like he tried to patch himself up.
Before Carson could stop him, Nunes raised a gauntlet and fired his grappler. The cable wrapped itself around the alien's leg, and Nunes pulled. The alien jerked to life. Arms and legs flailing, almost pulling Nunes off his feet. An ear-splitting scream filled the room. The Altari scrambled for purchase on the ceiling, trying desperately to get away.
Grab him!
Carson shouted, stepping forward to help Nunes pull. Despite the alien's constant flailing, they had it on the ground in a matter of seconds. Birch quickly went to work, securing its hands and feet with binder cables. The screaming continued as the alien rolled its body around, trying to break free of the Pathfinder's restraints. In the commotion, it had lost its grip on the cybernetic head, which bounced off the bulkhead, then spun through the room. The Altari twisted and screamed. The force of the movement ripped the patch free, and bloody fog spewed from the opening.
Its suit is breached,
Moretti said, rushing forward and pulling his tactical medical kit free from his belt. Carson reached up absently and caught the spinning head, then stepped aside as the medic rummaged through his kit.
Can you patch it?
I can patch it,
Moretti said without looking up. He produced a roll of wide black tape, pulled a length free, and pressed it against the opening.
Whether or not it holds or helps, that's another story. Regardless, we need to get him back to the Valiant. I'll need to treat him for exposure.
Whoa, Nunez said. You're not thinking about taking that thing back with us, are you?
I'm not leaving him here to die,
Moretti said. Birch used his mask to press the alien's shoulders to the deck. The Altari's struggle weakened, and Carson heard it speaking inside its helmet. It seemed weak, helpless. Thoughts of the Belisarius flashed in Carson's mind, a whirlwind of images spinning through her mind, corpses that screamed at her to leave this alien to die, ghosts that told her not to put her ship or the lives of her people at risk, ghosts that would never stop haunting her. She straightened after a minute, feeling the eyes of her team members on her.
This isn't the Belisarius, she told herself. That's not gonna happen here.
We came out here for useful intelligence. I'd say a survivor is the best intel we could ask for, wouldn't you say?
Across the bridge, Popoff was kneeling behind one of the chairs in the main ring.
I think I found a good access point. Greer, let me know if you get the feed.
A moment later, Valiant's pilot said, Got it, receiving uplink now. And we've got data transfer.
Just make sure you partition it off, Popoff said. It's not to let alien programs play in our computer core. Of course, the chance of anything even being compatible is astronomical.
Techs are on it, Greer said. They're high-fiving each other over an Altari computer they built back on Negev. Nerds. West pressed his palm to the deck, then cocked an ear to the ceiling, I think. The deck lurched under their feet. Carson dropped to a knee, grabbing the chair in front of her for support as its occupant was tossed free. The cyborg snapped back as its cables pulled tight, bringing it back into the chair. West struggled to keep hold of his captive as Nunez was thrown from the deck. Nunez twisted in midair, bringing his feet up and landing on the far wall. Sparks shot out from ceiling panels as they buckled. Metal groaned as the ship moved around them.
Greer, what's going on out there?
Carson asked. I'm not sure, Valiant's pilot answered. It's slipping deeper into the gravity well. The increased pressure might be stressing the hull. I'd say you might want to think about leaving.
You don't say!
Carson looked back across the alien bridge, feeling like she was forgetting something.
4 hours! Nunez snapped. Never trust a pilot's judgment!
Another panel exploded above her, sending a spray of sparks shooting into the room. Beams of light from the team's flashlights cut back and forth across the dark bridge.
Pathfinders! Carson called. We're leaving! Popoff, help Wes! Greer, we're coming to you!
I've got the welcome mat rolled out for you, Chief.
Heads up, Chief!
Nunez said. Already halfway to the exit, Carson turned, then immediately ducked as Nunez flew by overhead.
Sorry!
He flipped over, kicked off the deck, and shot through the hole he'd cut in the bridge hatch only minutes earlier. Carson followed him through, then stopped, turning back to check on her team. West was through a second later, bound alien survivor clutched tightly over his shoulder. Popoff, Birch, and Moretti slipped through in turn just as the ship lurched again. Watching the bulkheads around her shake, but the floating debris remained in place, turned her stomach slightly. An alien body just outside the door bumped off the bulkhead, colliding with another, pushing both of the corpses off in different directions. Carson pushed one aside, put a boot against the bulkhead, and flashed her boot's grav linings. She shot away from the bulkhead, flying after her team. At the end of the corridor, Nunez touched down and quickly kicked off again, pushing himself down another corridor. West seemed to catch on and kicked off the deck as well, using the grav linings in his boots to propel him forward.
Nunez, you're a genius,
Popoff said, following suit. As they neared their exit, the ship shuddered again. The bulkheads around them warped and began breaking apart. Dust and bits of metal rained into the corridor.
Don't stop,
Carson ordered, pushing herself faster. The gravitational stresses had pulled the opening in the hull to twice its original size. Jagged chunks of metal and loose cables floated everywhere, spinning endlessly, colliding with each other. Valiant's exterior lights lit the corridor like it was the middle of the day. Nunez and Popoff shot through the growing tear in the ship's hull, not bothering to grapple out. Carson stopped at the hole, counting as her team left the dead ship. Birch and Danielle made up the rear. The drone wrangler had the engineer by the waist as he jumped through the gap in the hull and made for the Valiant. The last out, Carson kicked out of the opening, flying through the void and falling into Valiant's cargo bay a second later. She passed through the force field, and the ship's internal gravity immediately pulled her to the deck. She rolled with the impact, sliding several meters before coming to a stop.
We're in,
Carson said, propping herself up on her elbow, looking back at the alien ship as it continued to break apart. Valiant's engines flared, pushing them away from the dying vessel.
Status check,
Carson said, turning away from the destruction, standing. Everyone all right?
100%, Chief, West said.
Popoff stood.
I'm good. But if we could stay out of collapsing alien ships from now on, that'd be great.
Nunez slapped her on the shoulder.
Oh, come on now, Cherry. Where's your sense of adventure?
My sense of adventure is just fine, but my sense of not wanting to die in a slow atmo burn is more important.
Several of the scientists rushed forward, obviously eager to see what the team had brought back. They clustered around West and Moretti as they knelt over the Altari, holding it fast against the deck.
We need to get him secured for the flight back,
West said.
He's unconscious, the medic said. The edema on his face is...
The hell with it.
He drew a Gauss pistol from a thigh holster. Before Carson could protest, Moretti flipped the pistol in his hand and hammered the grip into the Altari's faceplate. It broke after the second strike, and Moretti pried it open. The alien took in a deep breath, eyelids fluttering. It gasped for air, murmuring.
I need to get him to sickbay, Moretti said. Try and stabilize him.
Think you can do it? Carson asked.
Discovery learning,
the medic shrugged.
Standing around and poking him with a stick won't help.
West, help Moretti and keep our guest under guard,
Carson said. West flashed her a thumbs up and grabbed the alien by the ankles. He and Moretti carried the alien away, Birch following with his carbine in hand.
Ma'am?
Danielle said from behind her. Carson turned around and looked into the dead face of an SI head, crystals woven into a band of hair running across the back of its otherwise bare skull chimed against each other.
Holy shit!
Carson flinched back.
What?
The engineer asked. These are data crystals. She ran a finger through the dead alien's weave, touching wire filaments that ran into the alien's skin.
That old Tari pirate certainly thought it was worth leaving with this.
Carson looked at the trophy with disgust. Greer came out onto the landing connected to the bridge.
Carson, you all ready to- What the hell is that? Sweet Jesus, Carson! We send you guys out for like 5 minutes and you come back looking like a bunch of headhunting savages! What are you gonna do next, roast the prisoner for dinner?
The situation was fluid,
Carson snapped at the pilot. One of the other scientists extended two gloved hands to Danielle. His German accent was thick and he smiled as he stepped forward.
Let's get it in quarantine, shall we?
I thought Pathfinders knew better than to rub their faces into any alien thing they came across,
Greer said. Carson raised an index finger to the pilot.
We're doing just fine, thank you very much. You still have that ship marked with the intact propulsion systems?
The pilot nodded. Carson turned the finger to Danielle.
Prep your engineers, she said. Now we're on a salvage mission.
Finally! Danielle looked down at her fingers and tried to shake away Altari fluid staining her gloves. I've been looking for an opportunity to rip open some authentic Altari tech for years. Hopefully the engines won't be as... icky.
Work fast and work safe, Carson said.
Where's my blowtorch?
Danielle wandered away, still shaking out her hands. Governor Hale finished his walk around one of the salvaged Altari drives, then stopped and crossed his arms, looking at the engines that were a little bigger than a small bus, shaking his head. They were elongated teardrops of metal, with cut pipes jutting out from the surface seemingly at random.
Faster than light travel,
he said almost absently. Elias, Hale's teenage son, rubbed his hands together, his smile reaching from ear to ear.
Can you believe it, Dad?
I really can't, Hale said. But we've seen them work with our own eyes.
The twin drive systems the Valiant and her crew had liberated from the alien ship sat on the deck of Enduring Spirit's largest shuttle bay. They'd cleared out all non-essential personnel and moved all the remaining craft to other bays, giving the technicians complete control of the area. The Valiant rested 20 yards away, a group of techs crawling over her hull, already trying to figure out where they were going to cut, while Greer followed them around like a child concerned about their toy in the hands of their sibling.
Well,
Hale said, turning to the assembled engineers.
Do you think you can do it?
Danielle rubbed her chin, considering the alien spacecraft. After a moment, she blew out a long breath and said, It's definitely the same Altari technology the Triumvirate had us build for their ship. Essentially the same, in fact.
Weren't the Triumvirate imprisoned for hundreds of years on Negev?
Hale asked.
The tech you found today is identical? No design improvements?
I found it odd, too, Danielle said. 500 years ago, humans were using wind to sail their ships and bleeding each other with leeches to cure disease.
My team and I think that either the Altari and the SI lost the tech to build new engines, which doesn't hold with the carbon dating and metal fatigue we see on these artifacts, or they decided the tech was solved and refused to improve any further. Another engineer stepped up to the portside nasal and ran a hand down its smooth casing.
We lucked out with this thing.
He pressed a hand against the surface and a panel opened up with a low hiss. Inside was a ring of pale yellow crystals resting in nests made from golden filaments.
What is that? Hale asked.
We called it Astronite, Danielle said. The Triumvirate had us digging through mines on Terra Nova and Negev for months to find any. Lost a lot of lives in the process. And in the end, we recovered enough that was barely a tenth of that. The crystals are what make FTL possible. A play on an Alcubierre drive, but needing only a fraction of the power our drives use. That we found some on both Negev and Terra Nova led some of our planetologists to believe the crystals are remnants from a very old supernova, like any heavy metal. When the Altari figured out they could be used for FTL, she shrugged.
And this crystal doesn't exist back in the Milky Way, Hale said. Earth gets FTL tech and it would be a game changer.
Same as the Altari getting the Crucible tech from us,
Elias said.
The Crucible can open up a wormhole to a spot hundreds or thousands of light years away, depending on gravity tides. The SI and Altari can go from star to star at FTL speeds, but it takes time.
Hale shook his head.
Have FTL engines and the Crucible gates?
You'd be unstoppable,
Elias said.
Which we are not, Hale said, at all. We're not on Earth with all the manpower and manufacturing resources we'd ever need. We're hanging on by our fingernails out here.
How long until you can have an Astronite engine outfitted on the Valiant? He asked Danielle. This tech we know. She crossed her arms over her chest. Assuming there isn't any damage we haven't seen yet, give me 3 days. Then there are field tests.
I think you could do it in 2.
Elias held up his data pad.
I worked out the structural mechanics while you were on the way back from Negev and...
3 days, Hale said.
No, Dad, I said 2 if...
Hale looked at Danielle. She rolled her eyes and held out a hand to Elias.
Let me see what you've got there.
She glanced over the screen, then her eyes narrowed.
Have you passed the fundamentals of engineering exam? You've labeled everything to guild standards.
I passed it when I was 14,
Elias said.
Governor, can I keep him?
Danielle asked. Hale put a hand on his son's shoulder.
You cause a problem, and you'll be digging trenches.
Scout's honor!
Elias nodded quickly.
I want updates every 6 hours, Hale said to Danielle. If there any resource you need, you'll have it. Getting the Valiant ready to leave this star system is Terra Nova's top priority.
Chapter 4. A plume of supercooled vapor hissed as the coupling disengaged, and the hose fell away from the generation tube. The latch clicked open, and automated hinges opened the curved, transparent enclosure, thick with frost. Heavy vapor rolled out of the coffin as it turned vertical, spreading out over the metal-grated deck. Jared Hale resisted the urge to shiver as the cold reached him. He stepped forward, his footsteps creating swirls through the fog, and tapped the generation tube's control panel. Inside the tube, the dissipating fog revealed a still form, the tall, muscular, biological construct that Jared had come to dread. Long jaw, sunken eyes, and bald head visited him every night in his nightmares. Interior lights flashed and the nether guard's eyes snapped open. Its first breath was long and deep. Its blood-red eyes fell on Jared.
I serve.
Its voice was deep, raspy.
Who do you serve?
Jared asked.
I serve.
The nether guard said again.
A triumvirate.
Arise. Jared stepped back, giving the construct room to exit the tube. This new generation, designed with the latest modifications from Archduke Seaguide, was a significant step forward from the previous generations of the Triumvirate's foot soldiers. Waldo's arms folded down from the ceiling, fitting slate-gray armor around the nether guard's neck and shoulders, arms, and legs. The skeletal helmet and faceplate came last, locking into place with a metallic click. The nether guard moved its arms up and down, testing the armor's flexibility. Another arm lowered one of the new Altari weapons into the nether guard's waiting hands. The long gunmetal gray staff, topped with an energy blaster and two scimitar-like blades sprouting from the underside of the barrel. The Nether Guard spun the weapons, testing the weight, then hit the butt against the ground once, coming to attention.
"You are NG-1B,
Jared said, using the creature's batch designation. When it spoke next, its already deep, menacing voice came out with a digitized tone.
"Designation NG-1B. I serve."
Jared walked around the Nether Guard, inspecting its armor. "Where are you?"
"Generation Hive 1, Pod 1, Deck 12, on board the Altar's Wrath."
"Do you know where the barracks deck is?"
"I do."
"Good," Jared said. "Report to Bay 01 and begin your training."
"By your will, Battle Commander."
Fortunately, the ritual wouldn't need to be repeated. The rest of the Procy's hybrids would be directed by the ship's computer and fall in line with their senior Nether Guard. Now that the prototype had passed inspection, the rest of the tubes would begin their assembly cycles, producing a new generation Nether Guard every 10 minutes. Years ago, he'd led a platoon of doughboys in combat against the reptilian Toth when they attacked Earth. His doughboys had been far simpler than these Nether Guard, capable of answering only the simplest of questions, and good at only one thing, combat. The Archduke had altered the bioconstructs' programming to the point they could operate independently, vastly improving their coding. The core limitation on the Nether Guard was the same as the doughboys. They needed a leader, direction. These new Nether Guard had a tendency to freeze up if they encountered an unfamiliar situation. Jared knew the limitations Mark Ibarra designed the battle constructs with was likely the only reason the Triumvirate still needed him. He waited until the Nether Guard had disappeared through the hatch, then turned back to the tube and started the reset procedure. He set the automation routines, then backed away as the unit folded back together. Lights embedded into the ceiling came on in sequence, illuminating the expansive bay nearby, then spreading out away from him. Blue lighting around the base of each tube flashed, then held steady as each unit folded together, ready to begin assembly. In 10 minutes, 100 next-generation Nether Guard would open their eyes, don their armor, and take their first steps in the service of the Triumvirate. Jared's creations had been impressive before, even by Altari standards, but these new soldiers, with the new source material, weapons, and armor, they would be a force to be reckoned with, and that terrified him. He'd gone over the data 100 times, looking for a way to slip a flaw in, something that would give his brother an edge in the coming battle. But the Triumvirate would be looking for that, and all the Archduke needed was a reason. The only thing Jared could do was bide his time and wait for Ken Hale to do what Ken Hale always did, solve problems. The ship's comms crackled and buzzed overhead, and the Archduke's voice, digitized and deep, came through the unseen speakers.
"Servant, report to the bridge immediately."
The comms shut off before Hale could respond. Not that Seaguide would have listened to his response anyway. Out of the three, Jared hated Archduke Seaguide the most. The Altari cyborg never stopped plotting, never took his mind off the destruction of his foes, never stopped thinking about revenge. Had the Archduke been human, Jared might have classified the creature as insane. But he wasn't sure that term fit in this particular instance. The Archduke was simply driven. 5 minutes later, Jared stepped onto the bridge of the Altar's Wrath. The ovoid-shaped command center contained little. Several computer stations lined the sides of the room, and a raised dais in the center held a single oversized chair, 2 meters off the ground. The top of the high-backed chair was ornamented with gold and silver artifacts Jared guessed represented the Altari's history, or maybe tribal affiliation. Emperor Kyrios sat facing away from Jared, fingers tapping on the chair's armrest. The prince and the Archduke stood to Jared's right, discussing something on one of the monitors that he couldn't make out. They looked up as he entered, then returned to their discussion without so much as a nod. He wasn't worth their time. A wide view screen wrapped around the front of the compartment, displaying visuals from the system they just warped into. A blue-white orb hung against a backdrop of stars and a wide swath of orange-red nebulas, multicolored rings wrapped around the planet, similar to Saturn. The planet's only moon hung in high orbit, its surface cracked and broken. It looked like a huge chunk had been blown away sometime in the past, and over time fragments had continued to break apart and drift away. Jared stepped to the center of the bridge and waited. After several silent minutes, Emperor Kyrios turned, his chair spinning to face him. The Altari robot didn't look as menacing while sitting, but Jared didn't let his guard down. The razor-edged metal body and long, three-fingered hands could cut through him in an instant. The twin yellow photocells that served as Kyrios' eyes bore into him as the Emperor drew near. His metal face never moved as he spoke.
"The Nether Guard replacements. They are in production, my lord," Jared said. "I inspected the first warrior myself. Your creations are perfect. They will crush your enemies, my lord."
Kyrios said, long metal fingers tapping against the armrest.
"Why did your Nether Guard fail us on Negev? A handful of these pathfinders nearly cost us everything."
Jared went to his knees and pressed his forehead to the deck in kowtow.
"The fault is mine. Your brother is far more dangerous than you, a war hero. Are all human brood pairs so mismatched in ability?"
The Emperor leaned forward, examining Jared. Jared lifted his forehead an inch off the deck. A tinge of jealousy gripped his heart.
"My brother followed a different path than I. He chose to be a warrior. I was to be a builder. But the war against the Zaros changed my role."
"The Dark Tide,"
the prince rumbled.
"Your service will be tested,"
Emperor Kyrios said.
"If you are found lagging, you will not be the first to be punished."
He gestured to a bulkhead where Jared's pregnant wife and daughter were held in stasis beneath several feet of crystal. The Archduke looked up.
"You allow him too much, Kyrios. He is nothing more than a shepherd. You must rein in the wretch."
"A shepherd indeed, Sigite,"
the Emperor said.
"He will remember his place, will you not, servant?"
"Of course, my lord."
"Bah," Sigite said, waving a hand in obvious disgust. "The Nether Guard don't need a shepherd. They should be unleashed. Let them fight wild. I will harvest any useful subroutines from their remains. Nothing will stand against our armies, Kyrios, not even the rightly guided." Kyrios hissed.
"Do not speak their names, Sigite."
The Archduke took a step forward.
"I must, Emperor. You know better than most their scourge must be recognized. To destroy a thing, we must identify a thing."
The prince turned, his yellow eyes reflecting off the smooth metal surface of his featureless face.
"Sigite is right. We cannot ignore the threat. Their very existence is a bane to ours."
This wasn't the first time the Triumvirate had discussed the rightly guided, the faction that deposed the three and imprisoned them on Negev. But it was the first time they'd openly argued about them in front of Jared. He wasn't sure if that was good or bad.
"I will not debate this,"
Kyrios said, his voice never wavering.
"I am well aware of who our enemies are. I will not hear their name. Only after we wipe their scourge from this galaxy, they will fade into nothing, and only our glory will remain."
The two junior members of the Triumvirate looked as though they wanted to continue arguing, but a look from the Emperor put those ambitions aside. Sigide glared at Jared for a moment, then turned back to the monitor and his conversation with the prince. Kyrios stood and moved down the curving stairs from his dais to the deck. His unsteady gait slowed his progress. Jared would need to run another diagnostic on the Altari's motor function subroutines. It wouldn't do to have Kyrios fall and embarrass himself in front of the other two. The Emperor would suffer a lot of things, but losing face in front of the Archduke and Prince was not one of them. Kyrios moved across the deck, the clanking of his staff's metal heel echoing around the chamber. The golden haft was smooth, ending in the same gunmetal gray energy cannon the new Nether Guard were armed with three razor-sharp blades curving up from where the head and haft met. He stepped up beside Jared, his lanky metal body almost two heads taller than the human.
"Do you know where we are?"
Jared considered the planet on the screen for a moment, then shook his head.
"I do not."
"This is where our empire fractured. This was the first of our vassal planets to side with the traitors. From here, more worlds fell into rebellion. Many Ultari surrendered to the false promises before we showed them the error of their ways.
Kyrios waved a hand at the screen.
But this is where their fall began. What you see before you is the price they paid for their arrogance. A broken world, left to die and wither. Our mighty fleets cracked their moon, their god, and rained destruction onto their world.
Sea Guide scoffed. God indeed.
An unholy pagan belief,
Kyrios said.
Blasphemous. That they worshipped the very thing that ultimately destroyed them seems fitting, does it now?
Jared nodded.
It does, my lord.
Kyrios waved a hand, and the image on the screen zoomed in on the broken moon. A massive fortress came into view, built right into the broken surface of the moon. The superstructure stood hundreds of stories tall, reaching several kilometers above the surface and spreading out into a latticework of docking rings and massive habitat blocks. Large sections of the fortress were bathed in darkness, while smaller, seemingly random sections appeared to be powered as lights blinked on and off.
Our home,
Kyrios said.
Impressive, is it not?
It is remarkable, Jared said.
The station was probably twice the size of a crucible gate on Earth, and many times larger than the star forts orbiting Earth.
Look at it,
the prince said, stepping closer to the screen.
It's a travesty, a shadow of its former glory. It's disgraceful.
I do not disagree,
Kyrios said.
This fortress was once the staging point for our entire armada. Now look at it.
We are being hailed, the Archduke said, looking up from his station.
Ah,
Kyrios said.
Our flock prepares to receive its shepherd.
My Emperor,
the prince said,
I do not think our present condition is suitable for the menials to observe. That we are in the forms the rightly guided traitors made for us will not match expectations.
Perhaps you are right,
Kyrios said. He flicked a finger and several panels slid open in the ceiling. Waldo arms descended, carrying smaller versions of the Netherguard armor. Jared took a step back as the arms neared him, confused.
Be still, servant,
Kyrios said.
You shall be our emissary to the faithful, a herald for your emperor.
Jared held his arms out to the side as the arms fitted the armor to his frame, the red and yellow segmented plates sealing together on their own. It was surprisingly light, and as he moved his arms, testing the suit, he found that it didn't inhibit his movement at all. A yellow helmet, its face painted like a red skull, slid over Jared's head and the faceplate folded down, sealing itself into place. Pain flared through his skin as the suit adjusted to his body. He clenched his teeth against the pain as a cable attached itself to the port at the base of his neck just between his shoulder blades, and the interior of the faceplate came to life, becoming completely transparent. Holographic overlays hung in the air in front of him, displaying suit vitals, room temperature, locations of the three Ultari leaders, and their distances from him. His eye movement combined with his thoughts controlled the interface. The pain slowly subsided as his nerves became accustomed to their new inputs. He felt power he'd never felt before, even in the hybrid control suit he'd worn on Negev. Strike Marine armor was the closest comparison, but next to this, the old human armor paled. He waited for the halberd to appear, but one never did.
Typical,
he thought.
You will be our emissary,
Kyrios repeated.
It has been too long since our banishment, and I fear some encouragement of the faithful may be necessary.
They are disgraceful,
Prince Zvira said, his voice full of contempt.
Look at what they've let themselves become. The fortress is falling apart. Entire Hablocks are without power.
We shall remind them of our glory,
Kyrios said, stepping to the side. The central dais lowered, disappearing into the deck, and Jared stepped forward to where it had once stood. The view of the broken moon and fortress vanished, replaced by a true-born Ultari. The alien's face was lit from above, its black hair was disheveled, small gold rings pierced into its jawline. Its clothes were tattered, A brown jacket hung over a purple shirt. A large golden medallion hung on a chain around the Altari's neck was the only thing that looked like it had been cared for.
You're not of the clans,
the Altari said.
I'll give you this warning. Leave or die.
We will not, Jared said, trying to sound more confident than he actually was. Text appeared on his HUD, and he spoke the words. By the order of his holy emperor,